We're going to continue the hour now by turning our attention to gun violence in the wake of the spate of mass shootings that we've seen recently across the country. Folks are talking about gun violence more and more. What can we do to address it? As we are having this conversation, a lot of different ideas are being thrown around, but what do we actually know about gun violence? What causes it, and what steps and measures actually work to address it? This is a series of questions that can be addressed in a variety of different ways. Several UNC professors tackle this question from the angle of public health. We're joined in the studio now by two special guests. Shabarana Purwala is in the UNC Epidemiology Department. He's also the Assistant Director for Research Methods at the UNC Injury Prevention Research Center. And Beth Morocco is with the Gillings School of Global Public Health. She is the Associate Director of the UNC Injury Prevention Research Center, iprc.unc.edu is their website. Thank you both so much for being with us today. Good morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So let's get started with the very basic question. What do we know about the causes of gun violence? There's a lot of research out there. Obviously, there could be a lot more, but what do we know?
Well, I think it's like any other public health issue that there are multiple kind of causal factors. And, you know, a lot of gun violence has its origins in other types of violence. So gender-based violence or people who have suicidal intent or mental health issues. And so access to guns, which is a very lethal product, can exacerbate or amplify these other types of issues. And so, you know, we saw in these recent mass shootings, for example, we saw one case in Buffalo that was really motivated by white supremacy. And then we saw, you know, we don't know, but for Uvalde, but it appears that that shooter had some mental health issues. And so again, the kind of typical public health causal factors can be kind of underlying, but the fact that there is easy access to a very lethal means then just kind of amplifies the effect.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely what Beth said. As a society, we know violence has existed for a while and in all forms. But now, with more and more easy access to more lethal forms, as Beth put it, to perpetuate that violence puts many more people at risk. And we can, you know, think about less lethal means and what they would do instead. So there have been incidences of, you know, stabbings in London and other places, but not these many people die because they are not that lethal means, and they can actually, you can come to their aid much quicker because of those things. So yeah, the idea that this is a lethal mean and in hands of people who want to inflict large pain is a problematic situation.
And I think an important thing to keep in mind, because we're talking about this, and I think the conversation has really spiked in the last couple of weeks because of these specific mass shooting incidents, which obviously are kind of front and center in the headlines. But Beth, you mentioned it, that, you know, a lot of gun violence take the form of suicide, domestic mm-hmm. violence. That's your research. A lot of gun violence, the vast majority, right, of gun violence is not mass shootings. It's these smaller incidents that don't make the news. So what do we know about that?
Absolutely. We know that, you know, that actually it's death by suicide mm-hmm. that is the leading type of death that's perpetuated by gun violence, you know, followed by homicide, and that those have the origins, as we said, in different aspects of mental health, of, you know, intimate partner violence, sexual violence. And so, you know, addressing those causes as well as, you know, access to firearms can actually reduce lethal and non-lethal violence.
Yeah, there is a lot of evidence about, you know, all of those methods of having domestic violence protective orders for gender-based violence, and that prevents, you know, violence in their homes, and having extreme risk protective orders for people who are, you know, really in depressed state and are likely to hurt themselves or even others around them, so that they don't get access to firearms in those acute moments. And those kind of things can prevent larger calamities from happening.
And kind of going along those lines, we're speaking with Shabarana Purwala and Beth Morocco, again, both with the UNC Injury Prevention Research Center, talking about gun violence as a public health issue. And you've already both mentioned a couple of measures that can be effective at addressing gun violence. What laws, what policies would be the most effective and what policies would be the least effective? There are a lot of suggestions that are being tossed around for what should we do, what shouldn't we do?
Well, I'll start by saying we actually have some laws on the books mm-hmm. that we could do a better job of implementing and enforcing. And that's, I think there is a lot of momentum right now for looking at kind of new legislative solutions to gun violence. I think we should also be aware that, particularly in North Carolina, we already have legislation and we have laws that have widespread support, but there may be issues with implementation and enforcement. For example, Schauber mentioned domestic violence protective orders. Well, North Carolina is actually the only state that requires judges to inquire about access to guns during the protective order hearing process, and there's an opportunity there by law to restrict access to firearms in a domestic violence protective order, both in the emergency order and in final orders, and that restricts access in terms of purchasing, possession, or any kind of access to guns, ammunition, and if you have a concealed carry permit, having that revoked during the duration of the order and for domestic violence criminal conviction for domestic violence misdemeanor. And, you know, we've seen in our research that there are issues around implementation. So we know those laws can be effective. Other research has shown that in other states. Some of our research is showing that. But what we're seeing are some gaps in implementation. So that's one place that we could start. I think you've mentioned on other shows that there have been pretty serious restrictions on funding for gun violence research for the past 25 years. Thankfully, that has improved. But the research that has been done does indicate, you know, that, as Schauber mentioned, extreme risk protective orders can be effective. There's widespread support for background checks. There's some evidence that those can also be effective. And, you know, there are lots of other strategies that we can evaluate, like safe storage laws, for example, increased and more widespread background checks. So I think there's a lot that we could do in terms of new legislation, but there's also existing legislation that has widespread support that already exists that we could do a better job.
Shammer?
Yeah, background checks that Beth mentioned, we know there is widespread support. One of the reasons is because background checks is a way to implement a lot of the laws that we already have on the books. If somebody has a domestic violence protective order against them and they go to buy a firearm, which they, you know, the judge could have restricted them from buying a firearm, unless you do a background check on them, you are not going to be able to implement that. And so they are still going to be able to easily get a gun from, you know, very easily available local store and as much ammunition as they want to. So those kind of things, background checks are those. Again, for ammunitions, how easily people can buy and how much people can buy, that is a big issue. Why does somebody need 200 rounds if they're going to go for hunting? If you're going to go for hunting, there are special ammunitions and special kinds of rifles for hunting that you would be needed, not something that can, you know, shoot 50 rounds in, you know, a very short period of time in a few minutes. So that's essentially the concern.
And I think also, you know, one of the things we do in public health is we learn from kind of other public health issues. And so if you look like automobiles, for example, mm-hmm. what we found was when you raise the minimum drinking age, when you put stricter licensing restrictions, you saw deaths from motor vehicle crashes go down. Mm-hmm. Same thing with smoking. So, you know, again, access to funding to do firearm-related research has really been restricted, but we know so much from other public health issues. And one of the benefits of looking at gun violence as a public health issue is it can take the politics out of it and really look at the science mm-hmm. and say, if you look at something that causes over 40,000 deaths a year, that's a public health issue. So we need to look at it just like the way that we look at cigarettes, cars, you know, other things that cause injury and death.
This is one of the reasons why I was excited about talking to the two of you, because I just had the conversation with a couple of advocates for the North Carolina AIDS Action Network, mm-hmm. NCAN, and they have that exact same experience. You go to Raleigh and you talk with lawmakers, and you've got a very politically charged issue, AIDS and HIV, that leads to discussion of sexual orientation. It's all of these hot button kind of red meat issues that invariably crop up. But you talk about it as a public health issue. All of a sudden now you can get everyone on your side, Democrats, Republicans, everyone. Do you have that experience when you talk to folks from a public health perspective of being able to win people over who might otherwise not be inclined to support you? Beth, you're laughing, and I don't know.
Beth has more experience in that than I do, so I would defer to Beth on that.
Well, I just, especially also doing work in gender-based violence, which can also be very charged, and it really gets to people's kind of core values, right, around family and around privacy, and you know, and then when you put firearms into the mix, what I try to do is find common ground, and I think that public health is a really good mechanism to do that, because you say, well, let's look at this as something that causes injury and death. How can we, maybe it's making guns safer, maybe it's making storage of guns safer, maybe it's making ownership and access to firearms safer through background checks, through you know, educational requirements, through you know, permitting and licensing and things like that. So what I've found is that you know, if you, again, take it from this perspective of this is something that's causing a lot of death and disability in our society, how can we you know, make it safer and appeal to that common ground, like laws that we already have on the books, or you know, protecting families, protecting kids in school. And that's where I think we do find some common ground. Again, trying to take out of it, you know, I never wanted to. I'm not a legal scholar, so I'm not going to debate someone about the Second Amendment. But I can say, well, you know, here's what we know about making products safer, about you know, about background checks. Here's what the research says.
I agree, and I am not going to debate about Second Amendment rights either. However, I feel that there is no doubt in all of these policies. I think there's a lot of misconception that these policies are going to somehow infringe on the Second Amendment right. They don't. They don't preclude people from having firearms for even their own safety, but have a license to do so. I come from India. You can tell probably from my accent. We need to have license for most types, actually all types of guns in India. Second most populous country in the world. And with the amount of violence we have in India, if we had very easy access to firearms, situation would be far more worse than it seems right now. So I think, you know, there is a balance to be had in all of those things. We can't have extreme of one or the other. I think some of these laws don't really take us to the extreme. But because, as you both mentioned, it's become a political hot button issue, that gives a perception that these firearm laws take us to one extreme versus not having any of those is where we are right now, to the other extreme, where so many people are needlessly losing their lives.
Speaking with Shabarana Pawala and Beth Morocco, and as we start to wrap up this conversation, we've been talking about laws that I think are most relevant on the state and federal level. We've got a lot of listeners. Many of them are local elected officials, town and county. Are there things that can be done on the local level to address this? And even if people are not elected officials, just individuals, what can people do?
That's a great point, because actually a lot of the firearm kind of regulations are actually enacted at the state level. And so, in fact, North Carolina, particularly around domestic violence, has very progressive, well thought out legislation. So as I mentioned before, kind of implementation and enforcement of existing legislation. And then, you know, I think just as individuals, we can talk to and ask about gun access. I'm a parent, and when my children were younger, I would always ask, you know, if my kids were going over to play at someone's house, you know, do you have guns in the home? Are they, if so, are they locked and unloaded? How are they stored? You know, things like that. And I think that letting our elected officials know that we care about this issue and that we are in favor of like universal background checks, safe storage laws, things that are kind of common sense. And I think letting our elected officials know that we support that, because I think that there is some worry, some concern that this is going to alienate voters or alienate citizens. And I actually don't think that's the case. Every poll that's been done, every survey has shown widespread support, but maybe we need to remind our elected officials that we support these types of laws.
Another thing I think that we need to remind our elected officials is that if we close our eyes to a problem, then the problem doesn't stop existing, which is essentially what the U.S. had for many years done in not having ways to collect information or data around firearm violence, not allowing funding for those data to be captured in a good way, which has led to the problem now that in the research community we discuss again and again, okay, yes, we want to do research, not just on firearm deaths, because, you know, death is a last outcome until you think about preventing a death from those data, these people have already passed, but we want to think about preventing victimization and injuries and all of those things that come before somebody dying. But we don't have any data on those things. And so we need to do a better job as a country to, you know, invest in systems. We have wonderful data about motor vehicle crashes. We have wonderful data about opioids.
Overdoses.
Big pharma companies have been sued because of those things. Why not invest in, you know, more information that will generate information, inform everybody who are on either sides of the aisle? And then a more informative debate would follow that would probably not be so much roiled into the politics of it, but in fact.
UNC's Injury Prevention Research Center, the IPRC. You can find them online at iprc@unc.edu. Shebha Ranapurwala, Beth Morocco, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.